All right, my friends, thanks for tuning into the podcast, where, as always, we'll discuss the professional literature and the evidence-based protocol as they relate to the effective treatment of clinically significant anxiety symptoms. I'm Chris Lines, licensed psychotherapist and OCD spectrum disorders treatment specialist, and this, well, this is OCD Straight Talk. This podcast is made possible by NoCD. NoCD offers effective, affordable, and convenient OCD therapy. NoCD therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention, or ERP therapy, the gold standard treatment for OCD. With NoCD, you can do virtual, live face-to-face video sessions with one of their licensed, specialty-trained therapists, and they accept most major insurance plans. To find out more about NoCD, visit nocd.com. That's nocd.com to book a free 15-minute call. For people in the state of Kentucky, you can go to kentuckyocd.com. That's kentuckyocd.com and book a session with me.
I just don't remember the specifics of it, if I'm honest. But like he asked me a question like, why do you allow people to talk to you like that? Or why do you allow people to treat you like that? And I think he made the point of asking, where do you have control? Which I later learned was he certainly asked me that question a lot. And through the course of therapy, I became aware that certain people in my life had a pattern, a long-standing pattern in some cases, of treating me really badly. And I came to have this maybe challenge from him, or maybe it was just a desire. Again, I can't recall all the details. I ended up eventually talking with several people in my life and kind of confronting them. And like I remember my I'll never forget. I ended up asking him if I could talk to him, and we set aside some time and met. Like at some point he had made clear that he really didn't agree with my decisions on certain things. And probably the language he would have used would have been stupid. That's stupid of you to do. I understand that you may not agree with my choices. I understand that maybe these decisions aren't the ones that you would have made, but the truth of the matter is these decisions are not your decisions to make. They're mine. And I ended up saying to him, I'm not asking you to agree with my decisions. I am asking you to respect the fact that they're mine to make. And I remember walking away from that conversation feeling like I was 10 feet tall. Like there was nothing that he was going to say to me that was somehow going to spoil what I had just done for myself. Now, maybe I spoke some words to him, but really in the process, I spoke deeply and profoundly to myself, right? Not just that my choices are valid choices because they're the ones that I made and they're valid because I made them. But more than that, I spoke to myself that I'm powerful. I'm powerful to make my own choices, and I'm powerful to have my own voice in my own choices. And even if other people disagree with my choices stand because I made them. And maybe that sounds like a bunch of like circular mumbo jumbo to someone who perhaps didn't walk through the experience. Although I'm guessing there are a number of listeners who might say like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, right? So the opposite of it is like this concept where someone mistreats me or disrespects me in some capacity, and my lack of confrontation and correction is implicitly endorsing the way that I was treated. Right? It's sort of saying, well, I deserve to be treated this way, or the way that that person spoke to me is okay with me. And the evidence of that becomes that I didn't speak up and confront and correct the individual in question. I just sort of sat back and took it. And maybe some people would say, well, that's the mature thing to do. And well, fair enough, I guess. But for the individual with low self-esteem, it actually is not a very helpful response at all. It's an easy, or at least an easier response, but it's not a helpful one. It's certainly not an empowering response, right? So the harder one is the healthier one and is the more empowering response. And that's to find a constructive and civilized way to confront and correct. I deserve to be treated with respect. I'm not asking for you to approve of my decisions, but I am asking you to respect the fact that they're mine to make. When you did this, you hurt me and you were wrong for doing that. And some people, I think, might say, like, well, what if the person on the other side of this equation doesn't agree? Like, what if they come back with, well, you deserved it? And that's fair enough. But in my own experience with this, the message that you're sending to yourself when you speak those words out loud to the individual who disrespected you are so much more profound in terms of your own psychology than anything that person might say in response. You know, your words echo far and wide and shake deeply in terms of how you perceive yourself. You know, and somebody might fire back with, well, you deserved it, or well, you're stupid. And again, the notion that I just stood up for myself, that I defended myself, that I had the balls to correct that person when all these many years I've been silent, I've been passive. And believe me, my silence and passivity has also had a pretty profound impact on how I've viewed and experienced myself in those instances. So now to behave very differently and to stand up and say, you were wrong. I'm not asking you to endorse or agree with my decisions, but I do expect you to respect the fact that they're mine to make. You know, this kind of behavior, again, it speaks so much more profoundly to you than somebody else's attempt to put you back in a place of passivity and weakness. Once you've confronted, once you've corrected, once you've stood up for yourself and said, this is the way I expect to be treated, and the way you will come to feel about yourself, especially if you do that more than once, that is to say, in more than one instance, if on more than one occasion, you're standing up for yourself in a civilized and respectful way, no doubt, and you're correcting and confronting when necessary, you yourself are the most impacted recipient of those words. You are more shaped, you are more corrected by your own words than anyone else could be. And your words are more profound and powerful in your eyes, again, than anyone else's could be. And so I tell you this to make the point that behaviors are profoundly impactful in terms of how you think about yourself and the world in which you exist. The way that you behave, to say it in a way that maybe feels a bit more familiar, reinforces the thoughts and feelings that you have in the situations that you face. And what I'm meaning to say to you, and I've said this on a number of occasions, is that that includes when you begin to change your behavior. It's not like you have these thoughts and feelings, and then no matter what you do, it reinforces those thoughts and feelings. No, that doesn't make any sense. You take that example, and when I was disrespected and was passive and silent, that passivity and silence, which was really born out of the thought, I can't confront him, and the feeling of anger, but also impotence. And like I say, the behavior becomes passivity and silence. That passivity and silence then reinforces the thought, I can't, and the feeling of impotence. And maybe the thought that, like, I'm a piece of trash, and the feeling of self-hatred or sadness. And again, the silence and passivity reinforces I'm a piece of trash and I feel bad about myself. So it's not like I have these thoughts and whatever I do, I reinforce the way that I think and feel in the same old situations. No, as I begin to change my behavior. And I'm not just talking about minor adjustments, although maybe that's a good place to begin for some people, but I'm talking about more profoundly different reactions, different behavioral choices that over the course of time become different behavioral patterns, in turn and correspondingly reinforce different thoughts and feelings. So I immediately began to think I'm powerful, and I felt very proud and strong. It didn't take but a second. As soon as the words that came out of my mouth hit my ears, immediately new thoughts and self-perceptions sprang forth. Feelings followed. The question, of course, would become, well, would I do it again? And the more I did it again and again and again, the more I reinforced for myself the thought I deserve to be treated well. I deserve to be acknowledged and respected and felt proud and strong. So that's the kind of thing that I'm meaning to say, that when we get into anxiety systems, behavioral patterns are tremendously impactful and important in not just maintaining the strength of an anxiety system, but beginning to diminish the strength and the ferocity of that anxiety system. The systems with which we are thinking and feeling about ourselves in relationship to the situations and the world in which we live are maintained or broken apart by our behavioral responses to them. And there's tons of research that supports this idea. And maybe some people are thinking, well, but what about the exposure therapy? Isn't that something that is just as important as the behavioral change? And maybe even more important, isn't that the case? And I think that the answer to that question is fundamentally no, for two reasons. The first of which is, you go back to Victor Meyer in 1966, that initial study that sort of kicked off the evidence-based treatment protocol that we now know as exposure and response prevention, and all of the professional literature that was born from that study. When you look at that study and you really get into the nuts and bolts of what was happening, if I'm not misremembering, they were tying people to beds. There was some kind of restraint that was applied to the individuals under observation. And what they found was that restraint method was actually very important in successfully reducing the symptoms of OCD. So they had tried, obviously, lots and lots of other measures prior to the emergence of Victor Meyer and the study in 1966. But then, like, Meyer comes along and takes a different position on the treatment effort. What he wasn't doing was exposure therapy, maybe in theory, but not in practice. He wasn't doing exposure therapy. He was only doing response prevention. The point is that in the restraints, the evidence-based treatment was for the first time uncovered. And we learned that when we start to change the way that we interact with our thoughts and our feelings, and we actually exhibit contrary responses, we start to change the thoughts and the feelings that we have. And that sort of behavioral discovery has become a profoundly helpful and a highly versatile tool in the hands of the behavior therapist. And so I think that that's one reason that no, exposure therapy isn't superior to response prevention, but it's the other way around. The other reason I would say response prevention is superior to exposure therapy is because of that that 2014 study where Abramowitz and Jacoby stated in unequivocal language that if you're doing exposure therapy but you're not stopping compulsions, you're not going to get any better. This is something that Meyer was telling us back in the late 60s. Like, he was facilitating the prevention of compulsions and individuals were getting better. So, like, what makes you think when you do exposure therapy, but all the while you're doing compulsions, you're going to be doing anything effective and benefiting in some meaningful way from it? I mean, that's just silliness. You know, that's silliness. Of course, you're not going to gain on the OCD when you're sitting here feeding the OCD at the same time. So the fifth pillar is about recognizing the supremacy of stopping the compulsions and everything that comes before it. Pillars 1, 2, 3, and 4 are all building to, you could say, the entree, the main course of the fifth pillar. You've got to stop the compulsions. You've got to stop those. You've got to, pillar four, identify them. You've got to walk into this room, so to speak, with your eyes open. You've got to be looking for them. That's true. You've got to be doing that. You're kidding yourself if you're not really looking for that. If you're not sharpening the skill of finding compulsions and then applying the elbow grease, the determined effort to slow them down and stop them. And maybe for some people that starts with delaying them. Maybe it's like, well, I'll try and stop that behavior for 30 seconds or for a minute, depending upon how pervasive it might be for you and strong the urge might be. But like, even if you can delay it and begin to teach yourself that, well, you can tolerate the distress for 30 seconds without doing the compulsion. And if you can, and of course you can, if you can, then maybe you can do it a little bit longer than that. And so maybe you push it to 45 seconds or 60 seconds, or maybe you go from a couple of minutes to a couple more. You know what I'm saying? You just sort of stretch that time a little longer and then a little more and a little more, and you keep delaying it just a little bit more and a little bit more. It kind of reminds me of like when I always want to call her Rose, DeWitt DeBicator from, you know, Titanic. Kate Winslet, when Kate Winslet is in the movie Holiday and she's working out the older guy, and he stands up off the couch and she moves his walker, and he's got to take a couple more steps to get to the walker and then a couple more steps to get to the walker. For those of you who have seen, you know what I'm talking about. It's like that. It's like, so you're stretching a little bit more and a little bit more, and don't kid yourself. Don't like, well, I'm going to do this little subtle compulsion over here. You know, just between you and me. Like, you're not kidding yourself. Do your best to really stretch it out as long as they can without doing any compulsions, you know, and you're learning, you're seeing, I actually can tolerate the anxiety for longer than I thought I could. And okay. And so then maybe you stretch it out, like I say, a little bit more and a little bit more after that. Eventually you are going to arrive at a place where you sort of begin to forget about the intrusive thoughts, and you sort of begin to forget that you were feeling anxious to start with. And of course, maybe it comes rushing back seconds after that. But my point is, you have done something of extraordinary importance. When you work to stretch and delay and push yourself a little bit more and a little bit more, and eventually you start to find that the urge to engage that behavior is weaker than it was 20 minutes ago, or even 10 minutes ago. And the distress level has started to fall a little bit. Are we talking about profound reduction? Maybe not. But are we talking about any change at all in your distress level? Probably, depending upon how long you've been delaying and stretching and waiting. If you were at like a 60 out of 100, maybe now you're at a 55 or a 50. And I would say, wait a minute, you might not think that that's much, but something has happened here. You weren't doing compulsions and your anxiety has started to fall on its own. Like, don't miss the richness of that moment. The thought that you were having, you sort of forgot about, even if it was just for a moment. Again, don't miss the richness of what that means. What it means is that you don't need the compulsion in order to manage the psychoemotive symptomatology. You don't need the compulsion. In fact, when you get rid of the compulsion, you find that the intrusive thought and the anxiety that it causes tends to get quieter by itself. You know, like just delaying it a little bit and delaying it a little bit more and working hard to keep that going as long as you can. And once you slip and you fall, you pick yourself back up and you try again. Let's delay a little bit again. Let's push a little bit again. And those little inroads over time, and maybe that's a helpful perspective here. We're not talking about dismantling the OCD in an hour. That's not reality. What we are talking about is beginning to weaken it. Beginning to weaken it. Little by little. Step by step by step. Working hard to change the behaviors in order to reinforce new thoughts and feelings. Now, you're never going to arrive at a place where you have no intrusive thoughts at all. And you're not going to find yourself in a position where you're not anxious at all ever about anything. In other words, you're always going to have some symptoms, but it's going to be in working to change what you can actually control, the behavioral responses, that you're going to find you have secondary control over the intrusive thoughts and the anxiety that they cause.
Well, that's it for another episode of OCD Straight Talk. Feel free to reach out with any questions you might have to chrislines04@gmail.com. If you found the podcast helpful, consider giving it a 5-star rating or subscribing to OCD Straight Talk for structured help with your anxiety or OCD symptoms.